This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
We have a very terrific show for you today. We're discussing particularly a recent report that was done about pay gaps, especially in regards to sexual orientation. Now, we spoke with Andrea Lenoz. So Andrea is a PhD candidate in the Department of Economics at the University of Melbourne. She was formerly a senior economist in the Victorian State Government, working in environment and energy policy. Last week, actually 2 weeks ago, Her piece, Sexual Orientation-Based Wage Gaps in Australia, The Potential Role of Discrimination and Personality, was published and it received significant media attention through the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age and Pedestrian Daily. The study's principal findings were that same-sex-attracted males earned less than heterosexual males, while same-sex-attracted women were earning more than straight women. Andrea was quoted as saying that if employers believe heterosexual women are more likely to have children or are more likely to take on a higher proportion of child-rearing duties, and if employers believe this results in lower productivity, then heterosexual women may be penalised and receive lower wages than lesbian women. Now, we spoke with Andrea last week, or rather, Emma spoke with Andrea last week.
I did.
Yes. And the first question that Emma asked Andrea was if she felt the media did justice to the findings in her study.
I think that's quite a tough question. It's always very difficult to summarise research and research that's based on statistics in a one-page newspaper article, and I think the article didn't do a terrible job of that. I do think that I'm a researcher, and there's always qualifications around your research, and you'd always like them to get a little more airplay than they do. But overall, look, I think the point of the research is that there do appear to be differences in wages between gay and straight men and between lesbian and heterosexual women. And as a society, if that's something that we're not okay with, that's something we need to address. And so in that sense, I think the article got that main point across. And if that leads to further research and policy intervention, then I'm okay with that.
So they didn't offend you too much with how they reported that?
No, I don't think so.
Let's just dive into what the study is. Now, for my slightly forgetful brain, it's been some time since I worked with some of the stuff. Your study was based on numbers,
yes.
Crunching numbers.
Yes.
And the numbers, and we'll talk about a few of the limitations and some of the constraints with the numbers, but the numbers are what they are. They are reasonably well supported by other studies overseas, aren't they?
Yeah, so there have been very similar studies undertaken over the last few decades in the United States, in Sweden, I believe in the UK, across a number of developed nations. And generally, they find fairly similar results. So what they find is that gay men appear to receive a negative wage gap, as in they're paid less than their peers, and lesbian women either receive a premium, so they are paid more than their peers, or there's no difference between lesbian women and heterosexual women. So they're the general findings, and they're the findings that I've essentially replicated in Australia.
Now, those differences from your finding, the negative gap for gay men was?
It's in the range of 8 to 18% depending on the model. So 18 is probably an overestimate, yep. And 8 is probably an underestimate.
And the wage gap
for lesbian women? So depending on the model, again, it can either be 0, as in there is no difference, or up to 13%.
Okay. So these are meaningful numbers. They're not
absolutely
lost in the roundings, as it were. Because we had some social media response, I think Patrick put up on Facebook the study, and the response was, this is just a beat up for activists, and it doesn't mean anything. But the numbers are what they are.
Yeah, look, the numbers are based on data from a nationally representative and very well-respected survey of Australian households. That survey certainly has a lot of credence in the literature. It's the HILDA survey, which is collected out of the Melbourne Institute of Applied Economic and Social Research. So it's certainly not a beat up. The paper also has a number of robustness checks. So like with any study, there are lots of limitations. And one of the ways as researchers we try to verify our findings is to run lots of different models. Mm. And if in general our results come out to be fairly similar across those models, then we say we have some confidence in the results. And that's generally what I've found, that across these models, the results are robust and therefore they appear to be believable.
We were talking before about one of those things that often you'll have people say, yes, but a heterosexual woman, they have a career break to raise a family, therefore their wage growth effectively stops for the period that they're away from the workplace. But you've allowed for that.
Yeah, so I guess just to speak a little bit about the methodology, obviously people's characteristics affect the wages that they get. Their characteristics can be their age, the amount of experience, as you were just referring to, so how many years you've been in the workforce, your education, and even the occupation that you choose to work in. So all of those things can affect your wages. So in order to identify what impact or whether or not people with certain characteristics receive lower wages, for example, women or men or gay men or lesbian women, what we do is we say, let's control for all of the characteristics that we can observe, that we know about a person that can affect their wages. So let's separate out the impact of education and experience on wages, and then the remainder that we can't explain using all of these observable characteristics, we can then attribute to whatever it is we're interested in, for example, sexuality. So just to summarize that perhaps a little bit more succinctly, what we try and do is explain differences in wages based on observable characteristics like education and experience, and what we can't explain using those types of characteristics we attribute to sexuality.
So unobservable a bit. So that's the difference between observable, you measure, you try and take account of. Unobservable are just this pool of things that might be happening, could be happening, you can't measure. So you can't, if you can't quantify them, you can't feed that into a model.
No, so there are unobservable things about everyone that will affect their wages. And so in order to estimate these wage gaps, what we need to do is make some assumptions about those unobservable things. So, for example, the classic, one of the classics in the labour economics literature is ability. So we know that people who have high intellectual ability, for example, tend to be more educated because they do well in school and they enjoy education. So if we wanted to estimate the effect of education on wages, what we would also be doing implicitly is estimating the effect of ability on wages, because people who are high ability tend to have higher education. And so what we want to try and do is separate those two effects out.
Joy 94.9. You're listening to Lefty Pinkos on Joy 94.9. We've been discussing the study Sexual Orientation-Based Wage Gaps in Australia, the Potential Role of Discrimination and Personality, which was collated by economist and PhD student Andrea Linnows of the University of Melbourne. We next asked Andrea what was the relevance of personality traits in her study.
So there is some literature that suggests that wage gaps between men and women can be explained by the different personality characteristics of men and women. So if men have, say, the stereotype, for example, is that men are more assertive and more aggressive than women. And if that is valued in the workplace, then that might be one reason why men are paid higher wages. And so controlling for that personality characteristic has been shown to reduce some of the unexplained wage gap between men and women. So in my study, what I did is apply a similar logic, but to the study of the gap between gay men and gay and heterosexual men and lesbian women. And straight
and,
women.
And you found it didn't.
And I found that controlling for personality does not affect the results. Mm. So actually, it's not a story about personality, that the wage gap is robust to including the personality characteristics of the workers.
And it's something that was mentioned in our show last week was. You employ people who are like you. You promote people like you.
That doesn't mean they're more productive.
It doesn't mean they're more productive, but it does. It does explain probably the gender thing. But if you've got your sexuality hidden in a workplace, that may not have quite the effect. And so it's probably slightly cleaner measure you've got.
Yeah, and I guess just because a workplace rewards a certain personality characteristic doesn't mean, as you say, that. That person is more productive and should receive higher wages.
Yeah. Out of all this, and out of the results of the study, and we have a band of measures for both genders, is there anything that you can draw on to explain what is happening?
So,
assuming, of course, we accept that it is happening, it is not a beat up.
Yeah. yes, assuming that. So I guess there are few explanations. So the explanation that receives headlines is that there is discrimination, that yep. people are paid less because of their sexuality and nothing else. And I think that's a very real possibility, and that's a concerning possibility. Mm.
Because that then is, if that is true, and if it was proved, is evidence of breach of our law against discrimination.
Yeah, so in my paper, what I identify is differences in wages that we can't explain by people's experience in education and those types of characteristics. Yeah. So as we discussed, there are some characteristics that we can't observe, and they may have an effect on wages, and therefore my estimates are incorrect. Hmm. So that's one explanation. There's also direct discrimination. So it could be that employers are directly discriminating against particular workers and paying them less to do the same job. And that is not legal. Yeah. Or it could be a much more indirect form of discrimination that's occurring.
Yeah. The other thing you mentioned too is... not just the direct discrimination, but the huge economic cost of, I guess, not rewarding people correctly, not recognising ability correctly. The cost to the economy then starts to be quite huge, especially if you look across the population and this gap and the numbers involved. You don't have a productive workplace when you've got these, I guess, results that point to very bad behaviours.
Yeah. So as an economist, you know, we at least in theory believe that markets are efficient if they pay employees their marginal product. So what does that mean? It means they pay them based on their productivity in the workplace. But discrimination is not paying people their productivity in the workplace. It's explicitly paying either some people too much and certainly some people too little.
And it's where you have a situation where there's things at play that are invisible. You also get the situation where an employee won't come out because of the fear of direct or indirect discrimination, overt or hidden. And then they don't bring all of themselves to work. And you don't get the best out of them. In any event, there might be some wage gap with a particular employee, but they're not going to overcome that if they can't bring all of themselves to work and be as productive and as engaged in the workplace.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. Yeah. I mean, I guess economists are often accused of measuring everything in terms of dollars, but actually what economists are really interested in is what we call utility, which is a kind of a complicated version of happiness.
I was just going to say a happiness factor, which is pretty hard to measure.
So it is. So we use money as a convenient simplification of what we all know we're all interested in, which is satisfaction, happiness, whatever you want to call it. And so in that sense, discrimination is just inefficient because it's going to be reducing someone's utility.
Yeah. Now, as a result of this, you've got the study, you've got the statistics to work on, to crunch. What would you have liked to have had to help you arrive at more certainty? What's the next step in this sort of study?
So I think there are a number of things. The ideal data set never actually exists. It would be infinitely large. But this study is using this HILDA data set, which, as I was saying, is a nationally representative sample. But in the collection of that, it's a survey. In the collection of that, for the years I was using, there is no direct measure of a person's sexual preference or sexual orientation. So in this study, what I did was I relied on being able to use the gender of a survey respondent's partner as an indication of sexuality. So the way I identified a gay male is that if they had ever lived in a relationship in a home with another man. So that's clearly limited, but that was all that was available to me. But since then, HILDA has started collecting self-reported sexuality information. So I think certainly using self-reported sexuality will be really important. And hopefully that will also increase the sample size. So in my study, it's a very small sample of people that I can identify as not heterosexual, if you like. So in total, there's actually only 100 individuals that I can say are not heterosexual. And so that's a very small sample.
It's still a small sample.
That was Andrea Lenoze of the University of Melbourne speaking about her study, Sexual Orientation-Based Wage Gaps in Australia, the Potential Role of Discrimination and Personality. That was a mouthful.
Well, that was a mouthful. I think we were left with the feeling at the end of that there is still a lot of work to be done to get data that is much safer to draw a lot of these conclusions from.
I think what was interesting, and I will acknowledge that Andrea was very upfront about the limitations that she had with her data. But firstly, the small sample size was a little bit concerning for me, and the conclusions that she based on about sexual orientation were related specifically to the spouse's sex, and it did not take into account, obviously, because the study was called Sexual Orientation and Sexual Orientation Based Wage Gap, so it didn't take into account anything to do with gender identity as well.
Yeah.
And how that could have changed if people have transitioned whilst in relationships. And it was very focused, obviously, upon this very kind of heteronormative binary that we all seem to exist in.
The other interesting thing was that study took 2 years to get published, and it was peer-reviewed in that time. She had to rewrite it 3 times as a result of the peer-review process. And so her peers support the way it's done, and I think they support the conclusions that are drawn from the data as it stands, but there is a lot more work to be done.
Certainly. We will be talking even more about this study. You are on Lefty Pinkos here on Joy 94.9.
We are now joined from Sydney by Susie Russell-Guilford. Good evening, Susie.
Hey, Emma. How are you going?
Not so bad. Susie is a tax partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers in Sydney. She's the mother of 2 daughters and, since December, married. In the workplace, her sexual orientation is no secret. She's an out and proud lesbian. Susie leads the firm's Glee Network for gays, lesbians and everybody else, a very well-recognised trailblazing program in the LGBTIQ diversity space. In her free time, Susie is on the board of directors of the Stillbirth Foundation Australia. That is a lot going on, Susie.
Do you sleep?
What's that?
Do you sleep? Oh, you don't remember what that is. Okay.
Oh, no, I dream about sleep.
Yeah, you dream about sleep. That's so poetic. Thank you very much for joining us on the program today, Susie.
You're welcome.
Now, Susie, we've been listening to Andrea Linnows, and I don't know how much of that you got, but you'd seen the Sydney Morning Herald article about the study, which was quite accurately reported, which is all credit to them.
Surprising.
You're in the workplace. You're involved with a lot of this stuff on a day-to-day basis. We have a pretty wide gender pay gap. Does this sort of stuff, especially the sexuality pay gap study, have to be settled science before you act?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I did listen to a little bit of that that interview you just did. I think from my own experiences, I'm going to be very boring for you, but I haven't really experienced any inequality from my sexuality at work. Certainly nothing overt, and I don't feel like it's ever been an issue for me at work, and in fact it's been encouraged. I think certainly for me, the difference that I bring to the workplace is recognised. I'm a bit different. I'm very open at work. I think people feel like they can speak to me about anything, because when you're open and gay at work, I guess you've shared a side of you at work that people don't commonly don't often feel the need that they have to share. So people, you know, I think they reflect that by perhaps sharing a little bit more of themselves. Now, the gender pay gap, I think, is a different story. But I think sexuality-wise, maybe it's because I'm in a partnership which, you know, is predominantly male. And I was sort of laughing with my wife this evening saying that maybe it's easy for me because when I go to partner events, I bring my wife along, and so does everyone else. And she gets on very well with all the other wives. So it's not really an issue.
Do you wonder, though, in that scenario, I mean, you seem to have brought up the fact that I suppose maybe for them it's easier to relate because you also have a female partner as such. So maybe it's something that they find is easy to relate to. And in the study, it did speak specifically that same-sex attracted women were generally positively influenced by the pay gap rather than negatively.
Yeah, and I think, maybe that is true, that when, you know, perhaps, I don't know what the answer is and what
we're not saying that your partners aren't awesome people. I'm sure they're lovely and don't think a single thing about that. Just realise how accusatory that is. Well, maybe this, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think actually, you know, probably for the gender gap and perhaps the sexuality gap that you're exploring, it probably isn't so much the senior, you know, perhaps at the senior levels, it's perhaps more like the middle management where I think a lot of the bias sits. And I think, you know, for that reason, there are lots of different reasons why people don't feel that they can be open at work. I mean, the reason we set GLEE up in the first place was because I was quite surprised. You know, I was open at work and I just didn't think about the fact that other people didn't feel comfortable being open at work. But we did several surveys which showed that there was a much higher number of people in the organisation that identified with the gay and lesbian community, and we didn't see any of that, you know, around us. And I think there's obviously a lot more to the fact that people don't feel like they can be themselves at work. So that survey was obviously on people who reported themselves as gay and lesbian. But there's a whole question for me about whether people assume certain things about people when they don't know their sexuality. I think that's also, we see that at work sometimes, I really do think.
And that does seem to have been a blind spot in the research that that Andrea Linnows did conduct, because it was based purely on who the spouse was.
Yeah.
And it the piece that they were... Oh, my goodness, I've completely forgotten what that... It was Hilda, wasn't it? Yes, the survey was taken from. And it didn't include self-reported sexual identity. And there must be a lot to do with assumed sexual orientation. But, sorry, Emma, you were about to jump in before interrupted.
It was something I did raise with Susie earlier today. I was part of a survey at work a few years ago where... About half the employees responded, about 800 responded to the survey on diversity, and only 20 identified as LGBTIQ. Mm-hmm. Now, that is so many less than just taking a chunk of people off the street and seeing what the number is. And so that says a fair bit. Now, and I imagine if you did a little bit of work, that number would climb. But it seems very, very low, and probably says a little bit about how people viewed the workplace back then. But Susie, you mentioned the benefit to the business of people being able to bring all of themselves to work, and you've been quoted saying that.
Oh dear. I think it just, you know, makes sense if you can come to work and be comfortable at work, and talk about what you did at the weekend, who you've been hanging out with, and just have a normal conversation with people when you go for coffee, I think you just fit into work a lot better than trying to be something you're not. And we had an interesting, we did a workshop with the Pride and Diversity organisation at PwC, where somebody sort of tested straight males if they could sit in a room at a client meeting and not give away the gender of their partner. So if they could respond to all questions that are asked by a client, typically at the beginning of a meeting, about what did you do at the weekend, what are your kids doing, where do they go to school, did you go to the footy, all that sort of stuff, could they respond about their life without mentioning their partner's gender? And I think it was really insightful for the partners, because they realised how hard it must be for people who are not out at work to not even be able to have those most basic conversations.
It certainly does seem to be quite logical to be able to bring yourself entirely to work and not and be as open as possible. It makes sense to that you'll bring the entire of yourself also in a productivity state as well.
You're listening to Lefty Pinko's on Joy 94.9 and Susie Russell-Guilford from Sydney. Susie, one of the things that I've sort of written down as a note is, in a workplace where not many people feel comfortable about being out about their sexuality, do you just throw a network together to educate the workplace, get allies, and make people comfortable to do so? Or do you force it from the other direction, just have people coming out and forcing the issue through?
Look, it's really a hard one. When we initially formed the network, it was about a safe place for people to go within the organisation. So none of the mailing lists were public for people to see. It was about very subtly telling the organisation that there was a network that people could access if they wanted to, and not be outed at work. I think it's taken on a life of its own, and it's certainly got a lot of people who are part of it who are not gay and lesbian, and they are part of it because of the whole diversity play, which for someone like PwC is a lot about gender, you know, race, ethnicity, sexuality becomes effectively a segment of that. So I think it's great that we've got a network, but it's part of a much broader diversity play, because the whole issue about bringing your whole self to work, it's not just about your sexuality. I mean, that's a hidden thing that you can choose to hide. You can't choose to hide race and gender, but it's about people feeling comfortable in all parts of life coming to work and, you know, providing the most, like as you say, the most productive hours that they can when they're at work. And it isn't just about sexuality, but certainly Glee's encouraged just a network of like-minded individuals. And I think I mentioned to you this morning, Emma, when we spoke, is a lot of this, I think, is about commonality. So I think the reason that, you know, traditionally white Caucasian males have done well in the workplace is that there are a lot of them, and they share a commonality, and they feel comfortable working together.
They're everywhere.
And rightly or wrongly, I think that's what we have to encourage in, you know, in the gay and lesbian environment, is that we have to encourage people to feel comfortable that they've got a commonality and they can use that, you know, in the workplace for a better purpose. Glee, we were very conscious of Glee not being seen to be some sort of dating agency within the organisation. It had to be seen to have something a lot more powerful and have a lot more gravitas about being good for business. And it's about like-minded individuals understanding that networking with other like-minded individuals is powerful.
Isn't it a bit weird that always whenever there's supposed to be some sort of community organisation for people in the LGBTIQ community, we have to really push into the fact it's not a dating service. Like, I'm sorry, I'm going to change the topic just slightly and I'll come back. Sorry, I'll finish this. But I just think it's really funny. I was part of a social media group about homosexual gamers, and pretty much there's a big thing about it. This is not a dating site. Stop showing pictures of yourself in certain states of nudity. And it just, it makes, it seems really odd that we have to keep reminding ourselves this. And you've mentioned, obviously, was that a bit of a problem at the beginning? People said, oh, yes, yes, I get to, there's that person. Oh, is he out? Oh, no, no, okay.
I think it was actually, I mean, it, you know, we didn't really have that problem.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I think
people are more mature than I am then.
Well, I mean, I don't think, no one said it to me, but I think there was just, when we were setting it up, I think we were very conscious that we wanted to do a lot of external sort of client events, as well as, you know, obviously a bit of going to the pub afterwards and just having a bit of a chat. But it was a fine line. I think there is an external view, for whatever reason, that these organized clubs end up being some kind of dating agency.
There seem to be a lot of these other organisations that exist, though, which is very, very pleasant to see, which is... So there's a huge positive change that's happening here.
Oh, totally, totally. And I think, you know, when you look at the other big organisations in Australia, and, you know, we often get asked to speak because we were a bit of a trailblazer initially, and you look at the way that they have formed their own networks and how the networks talk to each other... You know, I think it's actually a very powerful community within Australia's sort of corporate environment, and one which I'm really excited to be a part of. If you look 5 years ago, I don't think we had any of that. I think Pride and Diversity only started measuring people's, you know, only started the AWEI index around whether people were working in inclusive environments, you know, 5 years ago. And now look at the way we're talking. It's just seemed to be an ordinary part of most corporates.
Now, Susie, this morning you mentioned something, a benefit to having these networks, in that it enables conversations about sexuality in the workplace to be a lot more open, and it has the impact of affecting quite a bit of change informally.
Yeah, I think, you know, just a very sort of simple example is, you know, we've got two children. I had both the children. I obviously had to have some kind of intervention to have the children. And you'd be amazed at how many female clients or staff feel comfortable approaching me if they're starting their own journey on IVF. It's just one very small example. But, you know, it's a much more personal interaction with someone than you would have had, you know, maybe before I had got pregnant and been a bit more open about myself at work. I think it's brought about just an enormous shift. And currently, you know, you guys would know, there's hardly enough hours in the day to do what we need to do, keeping up with social media, emails, texts, all that sort of thing. People just almost don't have the time to be bringing some sort of shadow of themselves to work. You know, there's so many environments that you have competing with your hours during the day. Being open is just easier, and it's also much harder to not be out in the workplace these days with things like Facebook and LinkedIn. You know, people get trapped and they get tripped over in terms of some of their postings.
Everyone has to be a spy suddenly if you should do that.
You're better to be open at work rather than and control your own reputation.
And maybe that's where some of the wage gap numbers, the sexuality wage gap numbers, have a kernel of truth, in that expectations in the workplace are so high that those who don't feel able to bring all of themselves, and they have to be guarded, and there are things they don't want to participate in, things they don't feel comfortable doing, maybe they do suffer that they just don't perform as well. And so there might be something in the numbers. But as we've discovered, it's very hard when you talk to people. They can't find an example where they could point to someone and say that individual has suffered because of a sexuality wage gap. And yet the numbers produce that outcome. But you struggle to find an actual live body that has suffered that way.
It'd be interesting to look at the industries. I don't know how in-depth it was in terms of which industries, but... You know, you might look at an industry which is, you know, which you would anecdotally say has got a lot of gay men in, and you wonder, you know, within that organisation, is there discrimination? You know, maybe not. I think you'd have to go down into the industry level, but it, But it's just as hard to look at the gender pay gap. You know, when you look at individuals, it's hard to get a real reason. It's just a sort of vibe.
And it also comes down, you've got the intersectionality here where you've got, you've got gender, you've got sexuality, you'll have race, you have all these other, you could have height even of all things here. So, but don't look at me like that.
Those poor little people.
It could be, it's a possible bigotry that could occur.
And when you take in disability, age,
yes,
all those things, there's so many possibilities.
But I like what you're saying, Susie, is that if they do repeat this, and because they didn't look particularly into certain industries, I would like to see particularly the industries, which looks like is going to be happening in the future. Well, at least if I have anything to say about it.
Well, they have opened up that survey to gather a little more data, so the data quality is improving. But then that just, you may find the gap closes as they tick off more of the characteristics that are causing that.
Yeah,
gap.
I mean, I was interested in that, the lesbian observation around lesbians not being quite so adversely affected as their female heterosexual counterparts. I don't know if you unpacked a bit of that earlier on, but that's something I suppose that I'd be really interested in that being investigated a little bit further.
Mm. Well, it seemed to be such a precise and overt comment or finding.
I was surprised actually the comment, which was looking particularly at that it was the assumption of that lesbians, like, typically for people would not likely have children. As we've seen, though, Susie, case in point, that's not true.
Yeah, because, I thought that was a bit of a strange...
Yeah,
strange
it seemed point. A very strange comment, but look, there is obviously much more to go into this.
Yes.
Susie, thank you very much for joining us tonight. I hope everything's going well with you. Thank you very much for joining us on Lefty Pinkos.
Thanks, Susie.
Cheers.
Thanks, guys. Cheers.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.